You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, last night, more bread and circus, more spectacle. You know what I think was really most important was this is the stuff that is not being covered by the mainstream media. The fact that, frankly, the questioners seem to know more about the issues than the questioned. We're going to get into that in just a few minutes. As we go through the program today, next hour, Maria Svart, the National Director of the Democratic Socialists of America, is going to drop by. And in our third hour, Everything You Know Is Wrong, about autism and about kids who are afflicted with it. So we've got that coming up. Some incredible audio and video of an Oakland police officer who had infiltrated the Oakland movement. And apparently this is happening in Tennessee, too. We're going to get into that in just a few minutes as well. But first, the European financial crisis is essentially grabbing all the headlines. The Greek prime minister has stepped down and been replaced by a fellow who was formerly the head of the... Well, actually, Mark Weisbrot would know this stuff. Mark Weisbrot is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and just back from Europe, CEPR.net, one of the greatest economic resources out there. Mark, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
Thank you for joining us. So tell us about the new Greek prime minister and what's going on in Greece.
Well, the problem in Greece, I mean, is that the economy is shrinking at 5.5% a year, which is huge. And they have 17% unemployment, and the government is cutting, is basically tightening their budget under orders from the European authorities.
And that's in part why their economy is shrinking, is it not?
That is shrinking it, yes. It's getting worse and worse. It's exactly what most economists would have predicted. And but they're still doing it. And so the former prime minister, Papandreou, last week tried to call for a referendum. And he couldn't really get away with that. The European authorities told him, you can't do that. They don't really want the people voting on something like this.
Right, because it might go like it went in Iceland.
What's that?
It might go like it went in
Iceland. Exactly. And so he had to resign. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you have a new president.
But the new guy is the former vice president of the European Central Bank, Lucas Papademos. And this is sort of like saying, okay, we had, you know, the banksters crash the economy, so let's put the banksters in charge of the government.
Yeah, this is even worse because the European Central Bank is, well, quite a bit to the right of your typical bankster. I mean, that's the real problem in Europe, is that you have a central bank that's not willing to do even what the Federal Reserve has done here to keep the economy from falling back into recession.
And some would argue because there's all these cross currents of, you know, like, you know, Germany trying to basically game the system, you know, some of the smaller companies, Greece, and some of the newer members of the EU, you know, trying to climb up the ladder. And I mean, there's all these different cross. I agree with Paul Krugman. This thing is going to fall apart and ain't going to go anywhere. But now we've got last night. In the presidential debates, Maria Bartiromo, if I'm pronouncing her name right, asked the question, what are you going to do if Italy goes down? This is the seventh largest economy in the world. And most of the Republican candidates basically offered platitudes. And then she or one of her cohorts pointed out that you know, we're one of the largest funders of the IMF, and the IMF is part of the bailout. And again, I didn't hear any kind of coherent answer about that. But what about all that? I mean, you know, what is the situation? What happens to us if Italy goes down?
Well, you know, I actually have been writing about that since August. I was hoping that somebody in Congress would call the IMF for have a hearing or something and ask them what they're doing in Europe, because they are part of the three, the so-called troika, the European Commission, European Central Bank, the IMF, are really making these decisions that are, you know, pushing Europe down the tubes. Italy, well, I don't know. I'm not sure what you mean by going down, but if they go into recession.
Well, if they go into bankruptcy, I mean, what if they can't sell their bonds? They're above 7% right now.
Well, there are ways from that. You know, they still have cash reserves, and they can, you know, even if they even if they have to pay 7% interest, they can do that for a while. I mean, if it gets to, you know, double digits, then you're going to see a problem.
Right.
And but I don't think, I mean, there will be impact on the U.S. economy if Europe goes into recession. But it's, you know, it's the financial crisis that could be even worse, because Europe's banking system is a lot bigger than ours, and it's connected to ours. And so it could have some impact, just like our financial crisis crashed a lot of Europe in 2008, 2009.
So that's the big danger, then, isn't that Italy won't be able to float a bond offering. The big danger is that the European banking system, principally the large banks, I'm assuming based out of Germany and the UK, might crash?
That's the biggest risk, but they are related. I mean, as the European authorities push the economy, your whole European economy, into recession, it weakens the banks and makes them more vulnerable.
Why would they do that? I mean, I understand that, you know, the neoliberal philosophy, you know, is this ideologically driven, or is there something in it for them?
Well, you know, it's kind of like, you know, in The Wizard of Oz, where he says, "I'm not really a bad person," tells Dorothy, "I'm just a bad wizard."
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit of both. I mean, there's bad people and there's bad wizardry here. I mean, the European Central Bank, as I said, is kind of extremist. They really don't want to take the necessary steps, which would involve creating money, like the Fed here has done, has created $2 trillion, you know,
right.
And you can do that when inflation is low. It doesn't really, and the economy is this weak and unemployment is that high, it doesn't really have an impact or a significant impact on inflation. And they don't want to do that. They don't want to be a lender of last resort, which is what a central bank is supposed to do. And so they're trying to come up with these other ways to do it. So some of it is just a very, I would say, extremist ideology, but some of it is also just old-fashioned greed, in the sense of the creditors, they're protecting the creditors. They want to squeeze as much as they can out of Greece and Italy and Ireland and Portugal, you know, on behalf of the creditors. In other words, and part of this is punishment, too. They have this idea that if a country borrows too much, then the people must suffer for it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
a morality play playing out here?
It's wrong, but it's really creditors' interest. I mean, creditors as a group, you know, mm-hmm. they want the debtors to pay as much as possible, and they're willing to push these things to the brink. Now, you could say it's self-defeating from their point of view, because, you know, they could have taken a very minor loss, almost nothing, back in May of 2010, when Greece's debt was only 115% of GDP.
Right.
And now even a 50% haircut isn't going to be enough. So they are making their own situation worse. So there's a certain amount of irrationality as well, but you can see that the greed is a motivating factor.
Bottom line, greed. This is just as we saw with Wall Street here, just as we've seen with the banksters, the movie Margin Call, the movie Heist. I mean, we're saying there's all these documentaries out there, and it's of course Ayn Rand elevating that to a religion. It's just incredible. So Mark Weisbrot, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR.net. Mark, in just a word, we have just maybe 10 seconds left. Do you think that they're going to come out of this okay, or is this going to be a disaster for Europe?
Well, it's going to be a slow train wreck, you know, in the direction they're going, but I don't think they'll necessarily let the euro fall apart. It's hard to tell at this point.
Yeah, okay. All righty, Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR.net. Check it out. Mark, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Interesting, thoughtful analysis. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Should the Occupy movements be infiltrated by the police? Should they embrace the police? Should they reject the police?
Occupy.
Take you back to mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Well, it was interesting to hear from Mark about you know, I think we can summarize. We don't know what's going on in Europe, but what they have done is they're saying cut government's programs, cut, you know, and you know, austerity, 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 which is the exact same thing that the Republicans were saying last night in the debate. And what it's doing to Europe is it's crashing its economy. And surprise, surprise, that's what the Republicans want to do here in the United States. And why? Mark Weisbrot says greed. This is the, here's an economist. You know, if you're at the top of the pile, if you're a bankster, you make money when the market goes up. You make money when the market goes down. You make money on bankruptcies. You make money on loans. You make money. I mean, yeah, they no matter what happens, they make money. Okay, there was an Oakland police officer who cop watch got a bunch of footage of this guy, sometimes wearing street clothes and sometimes wearing his police outfit. And that went viral. In fact, clip number 17, this is the police officer himself has now come out with his response to this. This is an Oakland police officer. His response is number 17. First, why he felt he had to respond.
The video it began to circulate like wildfire, right? So on Sunday, I think Cop Watch or Occupy Oakland, somebody retweeted it like every hour. A lot of these other people spreading it, right? To where, like, I'm on websites in Europe, you know what I mean? As like this infiltrator, right? This infiltrator of Occupy Oakland, of the movement, right?
So, you know, he's concerned. I mean, you know, he's been outed. And so he feels like he has to respond to that. So clip 16, he says, you know, this kind of bothered him.
So for someone to say you are a tool, if you will, of the man, it started to bother me, right? Even people from Oakland, like, yo, I know that dude, I went to Fremont with him. When I heard he was a cop, I couldn't believe that. Expose that sucker, right? To me, it's not black and white, it's gray, right? I'm a police officer. I'm a citizen of Oakland. I'm a part of 99%.
You know, there was one point in here where he talked about some communities bringing in outside police to police their communities and how those people could just see it as a job, but how he doesn't just see it as a job because he lives there. I thought that was a really telling point, which we'll get back to in a little bit. But anyhow, so the question that was asked when he put this video up was when he was, because he's basically saying, hey, I'm with Occupy Wall Street. In fact, clip number 14, here he is saying, you know, I'm part of the 99%.
First and foremost, like, I totally agree with Occupy Wall Street, even to an extent with Occupy Oakland. I am a part of the 99%. Being a citizen of Oakland, I identify with the 99%, but I also have a job to do, right?
But he also has a job to do as a police officer in Oakland. And so then the question was, okay, when you are in civilian uniform and civilian clothes and hanging out inside the community, the Occupy Oakland community, are you there as a protester or as a police officer? And I think he answered that here in clip 15.
Whenever I've been there in plain clothes, my objective wasn't to infiltrate the movement. My objective is to point out any agitators. Because for the most part, people are peaceful and they want to see change. They don't want to break out windows.
So if his job was to point out the agitators, I'm assuming point them out to police, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he intended to point them out to the Occupy Oakland people. But it seems that this guy is saying basically that, he's going undercover. So how should this be responded to? This is the Tennessean, the newspaper in Nashville has a headline. The Tennessee Highway Patrol, THP, the Tennessee Highway Patrol, went undercover among Occupy Nashville protesters. And Nate Rao wrote this for the Tennessean. And state troopers and Metro police officers conducted undercover operations in order to infiltrate Occupy Nashville protesters in the days leading up to the controversial arrests last month, according to records reviewed by the Tennessean. They said Tennessee Highway Patrol officers dressed in street clothes mingled among the crowd, according to the documents. They were instructed to wear, quote, blend-in clothing. And in addition, one of the officers, Lieutenant Preston Donaldson, even created a fake online handle to try to infiltrate the group's online chats. And he talked about how, he said, this is something he said in one of his emails. He said, if they start camping, I'm confident that a public health issue will soon develop. Then the health department can shut it down, and we, the police, will all look like the good guys. Okay. So, a question. You know, at what point are citizens' movements in public At what point do they have a right to be free of police infiltration? Or on the other hand, at what point is it actually important for the police to be making sure that people are safe? I mean, the Occupy folks, the you know, fill in the blanks. I mean, we're all citizens of the United States. We pay our taxes. We part of what we pay our taxes for is police protection. And if there are crazies or vandals or predators or you know, perpetrators of various, you know, provocateurs of any kind in an Occupy group, should the Occupy group be saying, hey, send some police officers in here? You know, everything we're doing is above board. Or should they be saying, you know, if you're gonna be here, at least come in uniform. We'll treat you nice. We'll talk with you. You know, it's like it's not like we're sitting around planning a bank heist here. So should the Occupy movements, A, should police be infiltrating them? My personal opinion is covertly no. B, although we do, I mean, most people want police presence in their community. I mean, Bill Clinton, his big campaign was putting an extra 100,000 cops on the street. Everybody was like, yeah, great. Barack Obama right now, he wants to put more police officers on the street. People in high crime neighborhoods are going, hey, yeah, absolutely. But where are the lines? Where are the lines drawn? My thoughts and yours on this right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. At what point do police departments step over the line when they do infiltration? Is it only when they provoke? And here's one other point. This is something that I find really actually very important. And this is the point of community policing. Community policing is that when you have people who live in the community who are members of a police department and their community and they're policing that community, they're far less likely to shoot at people. They're far less likely to harm people. They're because they don't view, generally speaking, they don't view the those people as the other. Now, obviously, some communities have huge schisms. You know, there's the rich part of the community, the poor part of the community, the white part of the community, the black part of the community, the Hispanic part of the community, blah, 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 blah. And I'm actually talking about, you know, within those subgroups, when you have genuine community policing. And one of the strategies that's been used over the years in the United States, and it was certainly used back in the 60s, was bringing in outside police. And we saw this at the Republican National Convention, by the way, in Minnesota back in 2008, is bringing in outside police into a community because, you know, hey, these aren't their people. And they're far more likely to behave in ways that are arguably, you know, inappropriate and violent. And this Oakland police officer who's kind of ruminating on this video about his coming in as an undercover cop and how he's kind of uncomfortable that he got outed, but, you know, hey, this is his job, and he's also a citizen. He actually addressed that issue, and I thought this was actually a thought. This was the thought, for me, the most thought-provoking moment in the entire six-minute video.
I'm a part of 99%. It's gray. And I guess maybe that's why it's easier for people to go police a community that they don't belong to. And maybe in their mind it's easier because it's just a job and they can take it off. I think about that kind of stuff when I'm not at home. I mean, when I am at home. Like, it's not just a job for me. I can't just take it off.
Yeah. So that's a good thing. So, you know, I mean, community policing, I think, is a good thing. But infiltrating movements? Rick in Sonoma County, listening on Green 960. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Yeah, I think that the police should be at these rallies to protect the public, but they should identify themselves. So they are, as you say, community policing. That way, if there's any problem, they can help the people out who are there, if the Occupy people allow them in under those circumstances.
Right. So that would be, you know, for every 50 or so people who are hanging around, there'd be a police officer hanging around or whatever. You know, it's a, just kind of randomly scattered through the crowd, clearly identified in their uniforms. And you know, like in genuine community policing, you walk down the street, there's a cop, and you know that this is this street is his beat or this neighborhood. And he walks down the street, people say, hey, how you doing? You know, it's a, like that kind of thing. That's what you're talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so do you think that the level of distrust and hostility between the police and the various Occupy movements has reached the point where that's impossible?
Just depends on the place. I mean, I think I saw on the news today that Occupy Cal, which is a university movement, I think that may be the first in the country that's in a university,
right,
that the police actually just provoked the protesters by wading in with batons and striking people with the, and to try to remove the tents as opposed to working it out through negotiations.
Yeah, and this
but
is...
I think right there, they've looked really bad.
Right, and this speaks to what that police officer talked about just a moment ago, and that is that campus police are almost never drawn from the student body. So they view the students as an other, and even if they are from the local community. And most of the students, most in larger universities and larger campuses, are not just local kids either. And so there's that sense of others. So there's less reluctance to use violence or to use the kinds of things that you would not, you know, the kinds of force that you would not use on somebody that was a friend or a neighbor or an acquaintance. And that's very interesting. Thank you, Rick, for your call and your thoughts on that. Charles in Los Angeles. Hey, Charles.
Yes, Tom. Actually, the occupiers and the police should be on the same side since some of these politicians, they want to cut police jobs.
Yep.
So the motto should be jobs, not cuts, jobs, not cuts.
Yeah, there you go. And I think that actually a lot of police officers were in the big vote in Ohio day before yesterday that they're, you know, John Kasich was trying to rip out the ability of police officers to collectively bargain, and a lot of cops were showing up. And,
exactly.
You know, yeah.
Now, I had to deal with some agitators. We had a Klan rally here in Los Angeles, so I went down there to peacefully protest. But we had some agitators out there that were really trying to start a fight between us and the police. And I remember this one skinny white girl in particular. She had the loudest voice I ever heard in my life. And she get right up there about an inch away from the policeman's face and just yelling all kind of obscenities. And they were really trying to get something going. Mm. I know the agitators wanted it, and the Klan would have been real happy if we all made the 6 o'clock news.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
As it is, myself and some others were able to keep the peace and say, hey, you know, if this something goes down, who's going to get cracked upside the head? It's not going to be that little girl. It's going to be us.
Yeah.
Who's going to be all over the news? And so we were able to prevent any violence there. But you got to be concerned about these agitators. You never know what their agenda is.
Right. And sometimes they're people who think that they're on your own side. And and they think that the best way to get things done is to get in the newspaper or to get arrested or to, you know, or to, you know, smash some windows or whatever. And, you know, I mean, I've known those people, you know, throughout my life. And then on the other hand, sometimes there are people who are intentionally put there by, you know, anyone from Bank of America to the police department to not necessarily Bank of America specifically, but you get the point, you know, to provoke things. Charles, excellent point. Thank you for the call. Terry in Rochester, New York. Hey, Terry, your thoughts.
Yeah, I just, you know, I think that when the Tea Party was doing their marches and they were carrying guns, nobody mentioned about police infiltrating them undercover. They were carrying guns.
Yeah, well, I'll bet the police were there undercover. I mean, I would be astounded if the police had not infiltrated the Tea Party movements or didn't show up, were not present.
But, you know, that's what I'm saying. They weren't saying that they were there,
right.
But these guys are carrying guns. These guys, the guys that are protesting, the 99%ers that are protesting, they have nothing. They've lost everything. Because
many of them.
Yes, many of them. And because of the Republican Party agenda is to break the backs of the poor so that they can't vote, so they can't have anything, so they don't have a voice anymore.
Right.
And that's their agenda. And that's why the 99%ers are out there, is because of the Republican Party.
Yeah, well, I'd say it goes beyond the Republican Party. It's an entire conservative, neoconservative, greed-based, corporate-based, bank-based kind of libertarian worldview system that is most on display in the Republican Party, but certainly not unique to it.
Right, and that's what I'm saying. And the thing is what the American people are waking up to after, say, 40 years of this going on, because this has been going on slowly but surely. They've been planning this,
right,
and they've been building this for 40 up to 50 years even, because you saw it when Nixon got pardoned by Ford.
Sure.
And everybody that wears a suit, and anybody that wears a suit, is okay for them to break the law or do whatever they want. And as long as you have high friends in high places, you can get away with a crime.
Yeah, I think it goes beyond clothing. I think it has to do with how much money you make and how well you're connected. But I get your point, and I'm solidly with you. Terry, thank you very much. Will in Blakesley, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will.
Hey, Tom, how are you? It's kind of a quaint thing, but I just wanted to point this out because I witness this myself. I've been to the Allentown Occupy things a few times. They have a small one, but they're still there, and they're still slugging it out. I saw with my own eyes two times the cops actually drive by and drop off Dunkin' Donuts coffee and donuts for the protesters. I mean, it was very cool to see. And there's no doubt. And I walked around and asked these guys, is that a common thing? And they said, yeah, the cops are totally... They're unabashedly in support of the Occupy people down there. So there's obviously cops.
Well,
like that.
I mean, and it's like
not, they're not all like Oakland, you know.
Yeah, and it's like in New York State where the police were ordered by the mayor. Was it which city was it? Was it Rochester or was it? I don't remember which city. Anyhow, it was one of the. The mayor said, "Okay, clear the park," and the chief of police said, "No." Sorry, no, it was Albany.
Right.
It was the state capital. And the chief of police says, no, you know, we know policing, you know, being a mayor, but, we're not going to do this. You know, what are you talking about? You know, you want to put police officers at risk? I mean, this is nuts. And I think that among the police departments, there is, you know, there are some folks who get it that they're part of the 99. And then there's other folks who just, like, you know, don't get it, for whatever reason. Well said, Will. Thank you. Ron in L.A. Hey, Ron.
Yes. Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Great.
Listen, yeah, I'm pretty much in sync with you on this subject. A couple of callers ago, a few minutes ago, really jolted me into something I didn't consider before, and that's people infiltrating the demonstrations for other purposes, like trying to provoke violence.
Right.
I didn't even think about that, and I wanted to join those demonstrations themselves, but I'm so broke I don't have the gas to go down there.
Yeah.
So that's how pathetic my employment situation is. But anyway, it would be great if figures like yourself in the media could actually interview the people who order the policy to infiltrate the police.
We have tried.
They're ordered to do.
We have tried.
Yeah, I'll bet. I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, trust me. We've got Sean Taylor, our executive producer, is one of the best bookers on earth. You are not going to find, and they're not just on our show, pretty much anywhere. You're not going to find the authority figures ordering these things who are going to come out and talk about it, unfortunately. Or at least certainly not talk about it on a talk show like this. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So at what point did the police step over the line? In Tennessee, when the Tennessee Highway Patrol infiltrated, was that even legal? Alrighty, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And just before I pick up the rest of your calls on this, or some more of your calls on this, just a quick offer that we're making to the Rick Perry campaign. Clip number four here, Jacob. Last night, Rick Perry had a little bit of a problem.
And I will tell you, it's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the what's the third one there? Let's see.
Give me five.
Oh, five.
Yeah,
okay. So
five.
Commerce, education, and
EPA.
EPA. There you go. No, okay.
Let's stop. Get the
next. Seriously. Is EPA the one you were talking about? Or?
No, sir. We were talking about the agencies of government. EPA needs to be rebuilt.
But
there's
you
no
can't,
doubt about
but
that.
But you can't name the third one?
The third agency of government,
yeah.
I would do away with the education,
commerce.
Commerce, and let's see. I can't.
The third one I can't. Sorry. Oops.
Yeah, he's got Mitt helping him. He's got Ron Paul going, EPA, EPA, please. It's like, no, 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 no. Turns out it was Department of Energy. About a minute later or 15 minutes later, he comes up and he says, hey, I just remembered. So anyhow, what we're going to, and with some, I have to, you know, disclose a self-interest here. This is an advertiser of ours. Edison Factor, it's good for the mind, and it is a nutritional supplement. Edison Factor is a complex dietary supplement for the brain, is especially formulated to act quickly and helps provide an important brain neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. So, Rick Perry and your campaign, if you would like, we will buy and send you a case of Edison Factor. And, you know, maybe you can get your memory back. I've been taking this stuff for years. I mean, these same ingredients. I've been using this product ever since it's been out. But I've been, anyhow, enough of that. Don't want it to sound like an ad. I just thought it was a funny thing. We will offer it to Rick Perry. Back to what the police should be doing. Alex in Santa Cruz. Hey, Alex, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. I like to talk about the demographic of the country and how it relates to Occupy Oakland and Occupy Wall Street. It's my belief that we're not going to see serious change until the middle class really takes on this Occupy Wall Street movement. What I see here in Santa Cruz is a lot of stereotypical hippie-looking kind of people. And
but those are the kids of the middle class.
Well, I'm perhaps so. I'm not so certain. And then there's a lot of homeless people that are there, too, in camp. And then there's a lot of, you know, grannies against the war kind of people.
Mm-hmm. And Which is also the middle class.
Yeah, and I'm not criticizing me. I'm just pointing out reality here. And the point is that the cops and the firefighters, the guys who are conservative, who are watching, you know, Fox News at the fire station, like right. In my fire station, that's the middle class.
Yep.
And those are the guys that are voting Republican and making fun of me for being a part of the 99%. And when they're supporting the Tea Party movement, and they're getting criticized for their middle-class lifestyle, their pensions, their salaries.
Right.
And, you know,
so you're a firefighter?
Yes, sir. And these cops in Oakland are probably, I don't know any of them, but based on my knowledge of firefighters and police officers, they're probably a lot of them are pretty conservative guys.
Sure.
And they don't really look, they look at this as an opportunity for overtime. You know, these guys that were working at when they busted up the protest a week ago, they probably got paid anywhere from $800 to $1,000 pre-tax overtime check just to show up at 4 o'clock in the morning, whatever time they showed up. And unfortunately, I don't think we're going to see change with this movement until the middle class, including these conservative guys who don't know that the right what the right hand is doing with the left hand, et cetera.
Right.
That's my point is that
yes.
I don't think we're going to have change.
So we've got to figure, in other words, we've got to figure out a way to reach the people who consider themselves independents and Republicans who are part of the middle class and point out to them that the 1% are screwing them.
Yeah, because check this out. Because in Oakland, you know, the government, the city of Oakland is totally in the red. They're hundreds and hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars in the red right now, right?
Mm.
Well, they're having to use more of their
yeah, it cost them $1 million to break up the
yeah. And these cops don't understand that they're suppressing a movement that is actually representing their long-term financial and political interests.
Yeah.
And it drives me crazy.
Well, and I think to some extent that is a function of the fact that you've got GOP TV, also known as Fox News. I mean, when Roger Ailes came up with the idea in 72 and pitched it to his boss, Richard Nixon, he called it GOP TV. And then, you know, Nixon didn't have the money for it, but Rupert Murdoch did. And so you've got GOP TV and you've got all these right wing talk show hosts. And they're basically trying to say these people, you know, are just a bunch of dirty hippies, blah, 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 blah. And they're not representative of average Americans. And in fact, I would say the young people in the movement are the children of average Americans. And there's a lot of people who are not young people who are showing up at these. So yeah, excellent point, Alex. I think you've nailed it. And that's going to be a real challenge in America. Jim in Detroit. Hey, Jim, we have a minute to the end of this hour. What's up?
Yeah, I county commissioner here in Michigan.
You're a county commissioner in Michigan? Okay.
And the Republican Party is pushing this insurance reform, auto insurance reform, that's going to remove a 40-year-old program that takes care of automobile accident victims for their whole lives.
Right.
And right now, there's a Americans for Prosperity ad completely reversing it, making it sound like the current law is destroying people who are hit in car accidents, and this would make them a great deal. But what it would do is cut off tens of thousands of profoundly injured people from the help they need.
So why are the Koch brothers interested in funding a campaign to destroy the ability of the state to regulate the insurance industry?
Because the insurance industry is incredibly powerful in the state.
Oh, and
it's a 40-year-old program developed under a Republican governor, and now they're destroying it because they want a few more bucks in the pockets of the insurance company.
Amazing.
And this ad is airing everywhere now. And
amazing.
It's really disturbing.
Jim, thanks for the heads up on that. I appreciate it. Maria Savard is next. She's going to explain what a democratic socialist is.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And what is... You know, we've talked about democratic socialism a lot. Bernie Sanders once, when asked how does he define himself politically, he said that he was a democratic socialist, not a member of any particular party, a political independent. But and then you always have to kind of qualify that. And I say the same thing. People say, you know, what's your political philosophy? I'd say I'm a democratic socialist. And but then you have to qualify it because people go, well, what does that mean? And I say, you know, like in Germany or France or Denmark or Norway or, you know, that, like that. And it's like, oh, is that what they call them? So anyhow, there are democratic socialists in America. There actually is a bunch of them, and they're organized. The Democratic Socialists of America, DSAUSA.org, is the website. Maria Svart is with us. She is the National Director of the Democratic Socialists of America. Maria, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, I should mention... equality in jobs for the 99%, economic justice for all. This is a public event in D.C. this Friday, sponsored by you folks, by Democratic Socialists of America, at the St. Stephen and Incarnation Church, 1525 Newton Northwest. You, John Nicholson, The Nation Magazine, other people are going to be speaking there.
Mm-hmm.
And big deal, and my apologies for not mentioning that last night on our TV show,
right.
Although I think people will track it down. In any case, tell us what... You know, how do you define democratic socialism?
So democratic socialism is fundamentally about democracy. And as a democratic socialist, I can see clearly that our political system is flawed. It needs to be dramatically improved. And part of it has to do with the influence of corporate money in politics. But also it means that the economy needs to be democratized. And a lot of people think of capitalism as, you know, the ultimate in democracy. But really, if you think about it, there are a few individuals, whether they work for one of the big banks or they work for the Fed, and they have a huge influence on our lives because they can make decisions about major investments. They can make decisions about, you know, what the casino that we call Wall Street is going to be doing. And ordinary people have to deal with the consequences. So we have this massive jobs problem right now, and nobody's really talking about it because the 1% is perfectly happy. They've been making out like bandits. And as a democratic socialist, what we want is not only a full employment program that will help put people back to work and increase demand in the economy, but we also think there are certain things that should not be left to the market. So healthcare should not depend on whether you can pay for it or not. Higher education should not depend on whether you can afford it or not. And that's the idea of democratic socialism, is that we should democratically control some major aspects of the economy and also some of the public goods that are available for everyone. We think there should be a baseline of things that are not left to the market.
It sounds to me like what you're doing is clearly and explicitly defining the commons,
mm-hmm.
the things that we collectively own.
Absolutely.
And you know, Ron Paul would say that the commons are the courts and the army and the police, period, end of discussion, that's it. and, you know, a libertarian. And on the other end, a democratic socialist would say the commons includes what?
The common, like, you know, the commons includes the things that are required for all of us to live a happy life and participate meaningfully. So if you think about it, the ordinary person today, we have to go to work and someone else, you know, the 1% makes decisions about what kind of work we do, what kind of priorities there are in the economy, and we don't have a voice in that. And the commons should be everything that we collectively have helped create and the things that are required to give us the time to be able to do that. So, you know, how can you educate yourself if you have to work super long hours just to be able to feed your family and still struggle to do that? That's why we believe that education should be free and accessible to all. Now, obviously, that's not something we can transition to immediately. We need to make education more accessible. We need to abolish student debt. But in the long term, that's the kind of vision.
So education is part of the commons.
Right, absolutely.
What about electricity?
Clean water.
Water, okay. Electricity?
Yeah, absolutely. Why should a few years ago, public utilities were privatized, and that's something that we need to return back to community control. There are some things that all of us need to function, and there's no reason that they should be left up to the market, and they should be left for, you know, some corporation to make money on, when it's something, you know, we all need light to survive,
yeah.
And it's something that should be publicly controlled.
My definition has always been anything that is a natural monopoly requires it being defined as part of the commons. In other words, there's only one water pipe coming into your house. You can't call up three different water companies and decide which one. There's mm-hmm. only one electric line coming into your house. And so, you know, that's a natural monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
And just parenthetically, about half of all the electricity sold in the United States, produced and sold in the United States right now, is still produced by community-owned,
mm-hmm.
you know, by the commons.
Mm-hmm.
But tragically, another half of it is, you know, the Enron bunch.
Mm-hmm.
And so medicine. Healthcare, is that part of the commons?
I absolutely believe so. How can you function and live if you have to pay for this? It's something that we need to have public investment. I mean, one of the problems in the healthcare industry today is corporate influence is so strong and the pharmaceutical industry is so strong that, you know, people can't afford their drugs. And it even influences the kind of care that's available, because community care, you know, the proven kind of health care, which is preventative care provided at the community level, which will prevent health problems from manifesting later in life, we don't have public investment for that because it doesn't pay well. So people don't need, you know, if you look at the pipeline problem, the problem in health care is that it's not valued as a society and it's not part of the commons. So people don't go into it, and then it's not even available for people that can afford it. I mean, our healthcare system, if you look at the numbers, is significantly worse than in a lot of countries, even though many Americans believe this myth that because we're in America, you can, you know, if you have the money, you can have the best healthcare in the world. And the reality is, if you look at the numbers, we actually have pretty bad healthcare, even if you have money.
Even, yeah. And with some little islands of,
right.
of excellence here and there. But,
absolutely.
The Mayo Clinic and whatnot. Which actually is run along rather socialist lines. Every doctor mm-hmm. after 5 years makes the same as every other doctor, regardless
exactly.
of specialty.
Exactly.
It's fascinating. Now, the classic definition, the Marxist definition of socialism, you know, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs, and the state basically, or the people, own all the means of supply and production. You are not using that definition of socialism.
Not exactly. I mean, as democratic socialists, we believe, and our founder Michael Harrington really talked about this a lot. If you look at history, capitalism did help unlock our economy and create a certain level of democracy. You know, moving from feudalism to our modern economy, people were able to move more. It unlocked a lot of entrepreneurship, and it certainly unlocked the creative potential of people coming together throughout our society and being much more productive. But the thing is, if you think about it, the idea of social and socialism is it's a social creation. All of us working together are able to produce more than we are as individuals. The problem is we create all this great stuff, and then the 1% takes it away, and the 99% don't have much of anything. So our definition is not the same as Marx, although we certainly look to Marx for some of his ideas we agree with. But ours is a little... not quite as radical.
I think his critique of laissez-faire, unrestrained, raw, naked, brutal capitalism in Das Kapital was actually accurate, that, mm-hmm. that it would ultimately become a cancerous system mm-hmm. that would consume itself or would devolve into a plutocracy.
Mm-hmm.
And what I call the cancer stage of capitalism. It seems we're here.
But I
don't want the government making my blue jeans.
Exactly.
You know,
and that there is a place, you know, we believe there is a place for the market, and I agree with you. We don't want everyone wearing the same gray shirt.
Yeah. Seen that happen elsewhere. It didn't seem to work out so well.
Absolutely not. And democracy and civil liberties are very important.
Yeah. Maria Savart, the Democratic Socialists of America, DSAUSA.org is the website. And if you're going to be in town this Friday, that's tomorrow night in D.C., check out the gig over at St. Stephen and Incarnation Church. It should be on the website. Thank you, Maria.
No, thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, geeky science. And I want to get back to this whole issue of police infiltrating the Occupy movements.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school. And proud.
Well, some did. Not speaking for myself, but I'm a total science geek. I've been a science geek my whole entire life. Since I was, 6 years old, and my parents gave me a crystal radio for Christmas, and it's like, you know, it was a little germanium crystal and a cat whisker, and you put it on there, and you all of a sudden I'm hearing stuff, you know, and there's no battery, right? It's like, this is magic. Anyway, total science geek here. Let me share with you my quick science story for the week, and then we'll get back to our topics and calls. Published in ProPublica, Michael Grabel, writing about how the TSA says it's full-body X-ray scanners. You know, what I refer to as the Chertoff. Because Michael Chertoff has made millions as the lobbyist and salesman for these things to his former colleagues at the Department of Homeland Security. The Chertoff porno body scanners, these X-ray scanners, these backscatter scanners, they're saying a group of scientists with expertise in imaging and cancer say the evidence made public to support the claims of safety. They say basically it's the equivalent of 2 minutes of flying. And in fact, I had a guy tell me this in the airport the other day. I said, you know, if I don't want to go through, I don't want to go through the scanner. And he says, hey, you know, it's the same amount of radiation as you get in an airplane for 2 minutes. Well, these scientists are saying, no, not so fast. They wrote a letter to White House science advisor John Holdren and questioning why the TSA won't make the scanners available for independent testing by outside scientists, which is a damn good question. According to the agency and many radiation experts, this is Michael Grabel writing, the dose is so low, even for kids or cancer patients, that you'd have to pass through the machine for 1,000 times. But in a letter to White House science advisor signed by 5 professors from the University of California, San Francisco, and 1 at Arizona State University, they point out several flaws in the tests. Studies published in scientific journals in the last few months have also cast doubt on the radiation doses and the machine's ability to find explosives. So basically they're saying, hey, you know, in fact, the professors note that the John Hopkins lab that tested that, you know, whose certification is being touted by the TSA, they didn't actually test an actual airport machine. It was done on a model that was built by the manufacturer, RapidScan, and configured to resemble a system previously tested by the TSA. So, and by the way, this the one person from who's writing about this, one of these scientists, says the real danger occurs if the machine stops in the middle of a scan. Because there's this pencil-thin scan that goes zip, zip up and down your body really, really fast. And if that thing stops in the middle of the scan, allowing the beam to focus on a tiny area for several seconds, given the backscatter works with a wheel rotating at high speed, the agency plans to use these scanners continuously 365 days a year, mechanical failures are likely. And if this thing fails, then people get zapped. TSA says, no problem. We have automatic shutoffs and emergency stop buttons. When the John Hopkins researchers visited the RapidScan facility, however, the automatic termination appeared to work, but the full results of the shutoff tests were redacted. They were all blacked out. What's more, the test systems did not have an emergency stop button. So it's like, what the hell's going on with these, and why won't they tell us? So that's our geeky science for the day. Okay, so this police officer in Oakland, first of all, let's just get the whole last night, the Republican debate, out of the way. Newt goes after Occupy Wall Street. Rick Perry makes a fool of himself. Actually, we are offering to send a case of Edison Factor, food for your brain. It supplements the brain. I've been taking this stuff and the ingredients in it for years and years and years. It supplements acetylcholine, basically, which is a neurotransmitter. We're offering to send a case of it to Rick Perry, help improve his memory. And full disclosure, you know, Edison Factor is an advertiser of ours, which is, you know, but nonetheless, I think he needs some. I do. But Rick Perry had a memory meltdown. Mitt Romney was largely unscathed, and therefore everybody says he won. But I don't recall him saying anything that was worth voting for him for. So I don't get the one, you know, win thing. Herman Cain, after being accused of sexism, calls Nancy Pelosi the most powerful woman, arguably in the history of the United States, elected official, calls her Princess Nancy, and then apologizes for it later, and then this morning came back and unapologized and said, no, he's taking back his apology. So just, you know, to get all that out of the way. I think the real story with the Republican debates is that the questioners last night had more information than the questioned. And all we heard were platitudes and slogans. Now, that said, the format allowed 60-second responses. How can you deal with real issues in the United States with 60-second responses? Speaking of 60 seconds, I just got a one-minute cue from Jacob. So let me get to this thing. This police officer in Oakland, who has been outed as having infiltrated the Occupy Wall Street or the Occupy Oakland movement, comes out and does his own video. And he says, hey, you know, I'm a member of the community. I live here in Oakland. And I was there, you know, out of uniform. I was looking for agitators. He said, most of the people are peaceful. He says, I'm part of the 99%. He talked about how uncomfortable he was that he had been outed. This video just went around like wildfire. But it raises some interesting questions. One of the points that he made was that police who come in from other communities just see it as a job, whereas he sees it as, hey, these are my people. This is my community. I thought that was an interesting point to make, and one of the reasons why you don't want outside agencies being brought in. You want community policing. But then, you know, should police be dressing up as if they were protest or just in street clothes and not identifying themselves? You know, my personal opinion is that any movement that's out in public should just assume that they're going to be infiltrated. And on the one hand, and on the other hand, that if the police are going to participate, if they're going to infiltrate, wear a damn badge. You know, people will feed you. People will be nice to you. It's like this is an opportunity to build a relationship with the community.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So your thoughts on that, and up next, and a Higgins alert, my crazy cat Higgins. Occupy Denver has elected a leader, and it's not human. Welcome back to the place where we ask, do we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? Is Boeing a person? Is GE a person? No, I don't think so. Oh, there's my cat. That's our Higgins alert. It's kind of a pet alert, actually. This is a dog in this case. In response to Denver Mayor Michael Hancock's insistence that Occupy Denver choose leadership to deal with the city and the state. Yep. Hey, we got to have somebody to talk to. You got to elect a leader. They elected one. Shelby is her name. She's a 3-year-old border collie. Yeah. Shelby is closer to a person than any corporation. She can bleed, she can breed, and she can show emotion. Either Shelby is a person or corporations aren't people, said a Shelby supporter at the time of her election. Occupy Denver reserves the right to alter leadership status, but for now, Shelby exhibits heart warmth and appreciation of the group over personal ambition that Occupy Denver members feel are sorely lacking in leaders some of them have voted for on national, state, and local levels. So she's going to be leading this Saturday's Occupy Denver march against corporate personhood, and invites all, which Boulder just overwhelmingly voted to say, hey, you know, let's move to amend.org. Let's amend the Constitution. And invites all other civic-minded dogs and their leash holders to join. Meanwhile, in Portland, Oregon, this is of special interest to those of you listening on AM 620 KPOJ in Portland, although also all around the country, Mayor Sam Adams, and you know, let me qualify this for people who don't live in Portland and don't know who Sam Adams is. Sam Adams is no swastika-bearing, right-wing Republican, Nazi, crazy mayor. Sam Adams is a Democrat. He's, I believe, the first openly gay man who has run and won as mayor in the city of Portland in its history. He's a progressive. The Nick Fish, the city, one of the city commissioners, was there with him, who is I don't know Nick well enough to describe him as a progressive, but something close to that. And the chief of police, Mike Reese, who I know nothing about. He's come along, apparently, since I left town. But anyhow, Sam Adams, the mayor of Portland, Oregon, has said that as of midnight Saturday, or 12:01 a.m. Sunday morning, his exact statement, they're going to clear the area. Occupy Portland will be occupied by the police. He said, apparently what provoked this or what the excuse is being used for this is that there have now been two heroin overdoses in this encampment. Simpson said the police learned that the man had earlier purchased heroin at the encampment. This fellow, they had responded to a drug overdose yesterday at the Occupy Portland encampment. And Sam Adams, this is the second overdose in 2 days. And Sam Adams, the mayor, is saying, I want to make it clear, this action is not an action against the Occupy Portland movement. He said, that's part of the reason why we're being communicative about this right now, that, you know, we're willing to use the police, we're willing to use arrests, but we're giving you lots of advance notice. That last was my phrase, not his. He went on to say, my hope is it will flourish, the Occupy Portland movement. It will flourish in its next phase with a focus on economic justice, not porta potties and tents. Mike Withey, a 46-year-old Occupy Portland volunteer, this is in the Oregonian, yelled, this place is a mess. Somebody grab a bag and clean up. He recently proposed that campers move to an indoor space. He said, we're not going to quit, but this is pretty much a homeless camp. We need to move to indoor space so our movement can occupy professionally, but I imagine we'll be split. I think some people will want to stay and fight. So there's going to be a General Assembly gathering at Terry Shrunk Plaza. In fact, it might be underway right now. I think it was scheduled for noon, which would have been an hour ago. No, wait a minute. Noon is an hour and a half from now in Portland time, West Coast time. So, yeah. So we'll see how this shakes out. And, I mean, this is a situation where you have a progressive town, a progressive mayor, saying and a couple of drug overdoses and saying, hey, wait a minute, time to move to the next step. What is the next step? What does the Occupy movement do? What is the next step? How do you know, if you move indoors, don't you just become like, you know, any other movement that you know, has a name and a sign on a door? Being outside and being visible and occupying is like kind of part of the whole PR thing, is the whole gestalt. On the other hand, if living outdoors is becoming miserable and a health hazard and the druggies are taking over, or the homeless folks are taking over, this, you know, whatever, is this really how you want the movement to go? I mean, I'm not sure I have it. You know, I don't have any answers for this. I'm raising the questions. But, you know, we are live in Portland. If any of our listeners in Portland want to call in and voice their thoughts on this, I'd love to hear them. But I think that these are the same issues and the same questions, that whether you're in a city where the administration is openly hostile to you, or whether you're in a city where the administration is, you know, Sam Adams in Portland saying, you know, that quote, My hope, he said, his personal view is that the Occupy movement had to evolve to realize its future potential. Quote, my hope is that it will flourish in its next phase with a focus on economic justice, not porta potties and tents. So what's going to happen? Where is it going to go? Where is this whole thing going? And when the police show up, and they noted that four police officers are openly patrolling the Occupy Portland area, four Portland police officers patrolling the camps. And, in fact, this is how they discovered this kid who was blue and not breathing yesterday from a heroin overdose and, got him out and got him breathing again, performed CPR on him, which is, the kind of thing that you want the police to be doing rather than shooting tear gas canisters at you. So, anyhow, Steve in Marysville, California. Steve, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, you wanted to talk about the infiltration of the Occupy movement by the police.
Yeah.
It's an old tactic that's been used that started way back when they were forming the unions, and they used to call them union busters. They would send, the companies would send out these guys into the crowd to agitate and gather information on the crowd, and they'd agitate the police The police could strike on them, and they did it in the 60s.
They did this back in the 19th century. Abraham Lincoln was the first president to use the word strike in public and talk about unions and talk about this situation that you're describing. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's nothing new, and if anyone's surprised about it, then they haven't paid much attention to history.
Okay. Yeah, well said. Steve, thank you very much. Brad in Mena, Arkansas. Hey, Brad, what's up?
Hey, Tom, what's up?
It's
what percentage of the 99% would you say is Republican, your guess?
Well, I think the stats are that about 25 or 26% of Americans identify themselves as Republican, or maybe it's 22%, and about 28 or 20 to 31 or 32% of Americans identify themselves as Democrats, and the rest identify themselves as independents. And
we've really got a lopsided Congress, don't we?
Yeah, sort of. Anyway, what's your point?
Why would any working person vote Republican? I mean, what's the incentive? Aren't they cutting their own throat?
Well, because they think that by voting Republican, they're voting to be sure that they are still allowed to go hunting, to go deer hunting and own a rifle. Or they think that by voting Republican, they're voting to make sure that their church doesn't get shut down. Or they think that by voting Republican, that they're going to protect their kids from scary gay people or scary brown-colored people who are coming from Mexico to get you.
I think most of that is a heritage thing. I think that,
of course,
because Daddy voted Republican, I'll vote Republican.
Well, I see what you're saying. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. My grandfather was a socialist. My father was a Republican. I'm a Democratic socialist / Democrat, liberal, whatever, progressive. I think that some generations rebel and some generations conform. But I do think that there are regionalities associated with this. I know when we lived in Vermont, the northern part of Vermont is called the Northern Kingdom. It's the poorest part of Vermont. It's one of the poorer areas in the Northeast and one of the poorer areas in the United States. And it voted solidly for George W. Bush in the 2004 and 2008 or the 2000 and 2004 elections. And it also voted solidly for Bernie Sanders. So, figure that one out. To me, it's fairly obvious. Bush was using the wedge issues, which these people think they're voting on. And Bernie Sanders talks about the economy all the time, and they get it. He's on their side.
When these Republicans talk to you and they want to carry on a conversation, they think that you think the way they do, even though, a big percentage of the people don't. This gentleman told me, I don't go up north and visit my family anymore because they're all liberals. I said, I'm a liberal. He said, you are? I said, yeah, being a Democrat means being a liberal, then I'm a liberal. And he got up, walked off, and never talked to me again. So.
You're kidding?
No.
Oh, my. Well, I hope he wasn't a good friend, Al. Usually you can,
well,
or excuse me, Brad, usually you can transcend those kinds of things.
Right.
But amazing.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call. This is the perennial question, right, is why do people vote Republican? And, surprise, surprise, for example, over at TPM, Chart of the Day, the regressive tax plan, Super Committee Democrats shot down. The Republicans in the Gang of 12, they want to cut taxes on the rich. I mean, this is the Republican mantra. It's all they want to do, cut taxes on the rich and reduce regulation in corporations. You'd think people would get it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world, and then back with this issue. How do we deal with this? Oh, and we have an Everything You Know Is Wrong.
Those bankers should have never been bailed. They should be sitting in the county jail. We gotta do something by and by. Walk down Wall Street and occupy. Doggone, occupation is on.
Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Just don't tell Herman Cain. He'll... Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria, sorry about the tasteless joke.
That's okay. Princess Victoria here.
Yes, indeed. We're actually offering to send the Kerry campaign a case of Edison Factor. One of our advertisers is a brain supplement, we'll see what happens. We haven't heard back from them.
And you never will.
Yeah, you never know. I mean,
true. Maybe they have a sense of humor.
This is good stuff, you know. It's like, well, we'll see. Anyhow, what's going on in the world?
A number of things are happening today. The Senate Judiciary Committee this morning voted 10-8 along party lines in favor of the Respect for Marriage Act. This is a bill sponsored by Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, Democrat, that would repeal the Clinton-era law, DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, that defines marriage between a man and a woman. So this would repeal that law.
And the reason why that's important, if my understanding is correct, is that DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act law, even in states where gay marriage is legal, still locks out people from many federal benefits.
Right, like filing joint tax returns, things like that.
Right. And so Dianne Feinstein and others, were there any Republicans among the group?
No, it was along party lines.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Where's it going? What's the future of this?
Probably not going anywhere very soon. A couple of reasons. One is there is some feeling that that Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, may not bring this to the floor for a vote, probably during the 2012 campaign cycle, that could determine control of the Senate because it's controversial.
Right.
And because it could force Democrats to take votes that could be tricky for them in their states.
Right. The Democrats who vote against it because they're afraid of the horrible campaign commercials that are going to be made out of it. This is somebody who voted to help the nasty gays. They're concerned about that. On the other hand, the Democrats who vote, those who vote against it will be pilloried by people who view gay rights as civil rights, and those who vote for it will be pilloried by Republicans who are going to say that who are going to use all the awful stereotypes and all the basically bigoted stuff that they. Yeah, I get
exactly.
It. And it's probably a good idea to actually, maybe it's not a good idea to wait. I mean, the president didn't wait.
Well, and Dianne Feinstein says, well, she's just going to continue to reintroduce it every session.
Good.
Al Franken went after Chuck Grassley, who said that it has always been between a man and a woman for the purposes of procreation, and said, I just believe you misstated the history of marriage. It's not existed as a union between one man and one woman for thousands of years in every culture. And he went on to correct him about men being able to marry many women and young girls and women being treated as chattel. And he said, further, if the religious purpose for marriage is procreation, why would we sanction marriage between an 89-year-old widower and an 80-year-old widow?
Yes.
So Al Franken had quite a lot to say on that.
God bless him.
Also today, the Supreme Court is scheduled to meet for a private conference. And the purpose of this private conference is to decide whether and how to weigh into the politically charged legal waters of health care reform. In other words, how to take up the health care cases that have been put before it.
The cases, appeals court that has said Obamacare is unconstitutional, and I think three now that have said it is constitutional.
Well, two have said it is, and one have said, well, we actually can't deal with it until 2014 because we have to wait for it to come into effect.
Ah, I see. Okay.
So there's two rulings for, one against, and one sort of
Right.
So they could decide today. We could get a, an answer later today as to what they're going to do, or they may decide Monday, but they could decide this afternoon. There's a lot of things they could decide. They're going to decide which case they're going to take, which bits of the cases, what questions they're going to consider. Obviously, the individual mandate, whether that is constitutional, but also some other questions like whether the law's Medicaid expansion and employer requirements are legal as well, how many other issues to take up. Also, whether the Anti-Injunction Act, which bars review of the mandate's constitutionality until 2014, whether that's okay. Also, the severability question. This is requirements that insurers accept all applicants, even if they have pre-existing conditions. So that's another thing. And then, of course, the whole question of whether any justices are going to recuse themselves.
There's
a lot.
Like, as in Clarence Thomas, whose wife works on the other side of this issue for a living.
Exactly.
For hundreds of thousands of dollars of living.
Exactly. And then the other side, of course, saying Elena Kagan, because they're alleging that she worked on the issue, although she says that she didn't.
Yeah. As Solicitor General of the United States.
Correct.
Fascinating. You know, this court is so political, and they have to know that if they take up this issue or if they don't take up this issue, either way, it's a political decision, because the more profile, the more high profile this issue becomes with regard to the Supreme Court, the more Americans are going to be reminded of the fact that it is the President of the United States who appoints members of the Supreme Court, and that the, you know, about half the Supreme Court ain't no spring chickens, and, you know, something to consider when you're thinking about who you're going to vote for.
I think it's going to be huge. The arguments will probably be in the spring decision, round about June, just as the campaign's heating up. Right now, the healthcare law is unpopular. It did not do well in Ohio on Tuesday. The Democrats have done an appalling job of selling this to the public. And
well,
if they don't do something about that...
Yeah, but let me push back on Ohio. Question three in Ohio did not mention Obamacare or the National Healthcare Act at all in any way. What it did was it took out three or four little pieces of it and said, Ohio will not do this, Ohio won't do that, most of the individual mandate. And so I think most people who were voting had no idea what they were voting on.
Well, that's hopeful.
Yeah. I mean, you read it, it actually sounds, it's phrased to sound actually fairly reasonable. You know, on first blush, you know, an average voter, I think, would have voted for. Anyhow, Victoria Jones. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Up next, Everything You Know Is Wrong About Energy Work and Kids in Trouble.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes, like the Fire Sign Theater says...
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is everything you know wrong about energetically sensitive kids? Lori Ferris and Michael Simonson are with us with the Hunter School, hunterschool.org, up in New Hampshire. And first of all, welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. And Lori, let me start with you. You and your son Zach, who was 10 at the time, and this was just last year, I'm guessing he's still 10 or maybe he's 11 by now, were on Oprah's show. In fact, we have a couple of clips from this that if we get an opportunity to, we'll play. And could you describe to us, who are these energetically sensitive kids, and how did you discover that you had one?
Well, there's an epidemic of kids who we believe these are very, very intelligent children, they're very creative, and they're also highly sensitive to the negative thoughts that are in our collective consciousness and in our world. We live in a world that is filled with a lot of fear, a lot of worry, and anger, And as parents, when you have a child who's extremely sensitive and you don't understand these energies, it's hard to understand what's happening to your child and how they're perceiving their world and environment.
So, and Lori, what labels had been attached to your son? Give us a sense of, you know, what was the challenge that as a parent you were facing?
Sure. Zach had a multitude of diagnoses, severe ADHD, sensory processing disorder, nonverbal learning disorder, unspecified mood disorder, and Tourette's. And you'll notice nearly all of these labels include the word disorder. There was also a multitude of other things such as Asperger's that were thrown in the mix.
Mm-hmm. And he had been violent?
Very violent towards the end, yes.
Yeah, okay. And Michael Simonson, you came to Hunter School where Zach ended up and worked with Zach. You work with what you're referring to as energy work. Describe that to us, please.
Well, our thoughts are energy. So I teach the children that they can control their thoughts, their emotions, and feelings. They can create from what I call a positive, loving place in their choices. Or if they let anger or negativity control them, then they create from that place, and of course they have a negative experience or a negative day. I teach them that they're totally responsible for the type of day they have through the choices that they make.
Now, here's a clip. This is 30 seconds of Oprah interviewing 10-year-old Zachary. Clip 12, Jacob.
And now, the way you calm and prevent the negative energy from entering your physical space, your body space, is that you do what? What do you do now to prevent that from happening?
I do my white light. I just say stuff like, I am love, I am light, I am cool, I am awesome, I am perfect, I am wise, when I choose love. And that helps me calm down.
That could be a good lesson for the world, don't you think?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Not just for you.
No, for the whole world.
I think the whole world could use some calm and white light.
They need it.
Yes, they do.
So, Lori, back, you know, a decade or so ago, when Hunter School was started, hunterschool.org, by the way, is the website, when this was started, most of the kids were being diagnosed with ADHD. These kids... And I think, you know, a lot of kids with ADHD are still underserved, but this is like the next step in severity, it seems. And these kids, what resources do they have available to them if they don't know about, for example, energetic healing programs like you and Michael are working with at Hunter School?
Well, there's a multitude of, you know, behavioral plans and things like this that different medical folks will offer you. But one of the only things and the major tools, at least, that we were offered in our search was medications.
Antipsychotic drugs?
Yes, antipsychotic drugs. And, you know, in our case and in the case of many parents that I speak with, not only do they not work, but some of them actually cause some pretty severe adverse reactions, both physically and mentally, in these very young children.
Yeah, this is extraordinary. And now we're seeing, you know, 15, 20 years ago, it was like 1 in 10 or 20,000 kids. Now it's 1 in 100 kids are getting labeled with this. And being born into this. Here's another clip of your son, Zachary, 10-year-old Zachary, being interviewed by Oprah Winfrey.
When I'm doing an interview with somebody who's full of negativity, I surround myself with that light to try to keep myself from having that energy enter my space. So
don't try. Do.
Don't try.
Do.
Do.
Yeah.
You're right about that.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you worry about what you might do in the future?
No.
You're not worried about that?
No.
Because you think you can control it.
I am controlling it.
Okay. Don't think. Do.
Do, yes.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Michael, our executive producer, says, 10-year-old Zen master. Michael, you started this pilot program at Hunter School. How's this? Did I say not say Jacob? Yeah. What did I say? Oh, I said Michael. I'm sorry. Yeah, Jacob is our producer. Michael is our guest. Michael, you started this pilot. I need some more Hunter, some more of my... Anyhow, Michael, you started this pilot program at Hunter School. How's it working out, and what kind of reception are you getting from the academic and medical community?
Well, there's a great deal of interest from both of those communities, which to me is really, really good. the fact that they're willing to look at this and to expand their understanding of this stuff and to actually support it. Plymouth State University is interested in what we're doing at the Hunter School, which to me is awesome because it is an opportunity to bring this type of work into the mainstream,
mm-hmm.
to show people that there's other ways of helping these children besides the traditional ways, and mostly that's just been medication.
Right. Do you find yourself in some situations having to use the language of, academic language or psychological language, like saying, well, this is, you could think of this as a variation on cognitive behavioral therapy, but we're calling, or do you just say, hey, we're doing energy, well, you describe what you call this, how you describe it, and how you talk, how do you talk to somebody? How do you talk to a professional who doesn't understand what you're doing?
The same way I talk to children, that our thoughts are energy and that, everything that we think we project and all of us pick up on emotions and feelings of what we think. I mean, if you've been around somebody who's been really angry, you'll find yourself being affected in a negative way.
Mm-hmm.
If you're around somebody who's really happy, you'll find your energies shifting up and feeling better.
Yeah. It's kind of, human nature 101 in a way. It's taken to an art form. Lori, how's Zach doing now?
Zach is doing fantastic overall. He's been off of medication for almost 2 years. He functions beautifully without a 101 aid. He had a 101 his entire year. But the best part is he no longer has rages, and he hasn't had a rage in several years, and he feels good about himself. His self-esteem is good, and he's a completely different child than 3 years ago prior to this process.
And these were rages where people, where you as his mother, actually felt your life was at risk?
Yes, this was not a normal tantrum. This was... these were very, very violent incidents, which, by the way, a lot of the folks that I do talk to and that responded after the Oprah show are dealing with the same type of extreme behavior with these children these days.
So where can people who need help find information about what you're doing, Lori and Michael?
Okay. Well, we're in the process of setting up and creating learning opportunities through the Hunter School, through workshops, newsletters, discussion groups. And people can also go to the hunterschool.org or energeticallysensitivechild.com for just information about these energetically sensitive children and the program at the Hunter School.
That's great. Lori Ferris, Michael Simonson, thank you both for the great work you're doing and for being with us today.
Welcome. Thanks for having us.
It's an honor to have you both on. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Back to Occupy Portland, Occupy Wall Street. Stick around.
Teach your children well. Their fathers have did slowly go by.
Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Rick Perry had a bit of a disaster last night. Here's his mental train wreck.
And I will tell you, it's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the, what's the third one there? Let's see.
Five.
Okay. So commerce, education, and
EPA?
EPA. There you go. No, okay.
Let's stop the other day.
Seriously? Is EPA the one you were talking about? Or?
No, sir. We were talking about the agencies of government. EPA needs to be rebuilt.
But
there's no doubt about that.
But you can't name the third one?
The third agency of government,
yeah.
I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see. I can't. The third one, I can't. Sorry. Oops.
Yeah, oops. So we at the Tom Hartman Program is offering to send a case. We will pay for it to send a case of Edison Factor, a product made by one of our advertisers, good for the food for your brain, to Rick Perry. Rick, give us a call. We'll get it to you. 866-97-THOM, our telephone number. And Dave in Orange County, California. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, three reasons to keep the Department of Education there. First one's Rick, second one's Perry, and I forgot the third.
I had a horrible feeling something like that was coming.
any rate, You know, I wanted to kind of cover a little bit of ground here, but real quick, the police, especially in Oakland here, mm-hmm. coming up with an imminent raid, that they have more in common with Occupy Wall Street than they realize. I wanted to bring you up today. Today, a suit was filed in Manhattan against U.S. Bancorp by an Oklahoma police pension fund. And what that suit involves is the fact that that pension fund was sold mortgage-backed securities that had no mortgages in them. Complete out-and-out fraud.
Right.
This was very, very common, especially toward the end of this big boom, where they were selling these mortgage-backed securities faster.
Well, this is what John Kasich was doing to the teacher's pension fund in Ohio when he was a banker on Wall Street before he became governor.
I'll wrap this around into a tangent. When somebody tells you it was the CRA that made them give mortgages to poor people, no, it was not. They were desperate to fill these empty boxes with mortgages. That's why anybody who could breathe got a loan.
Yeah, yeah. So here you have a police officer's pension fund suing one of the banks. And yeah, I'm with you. The cops should get it. And many of them do. You know that they are the 99. Many of them don't. It's interesting. Bob in Naperville, Illinois. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Yeah. First off, I wanted to say thank you very much for all the talking that you do about the movement. It helps us a lot out here, especially in the Midwest.
Well, I think movement politics is far more important than partisan politics or party politics. It is and always has been the core of what moves America forward.
Absolutely, and that's part of what the Occupied movement is about. That's exactly it. The one point I wanted to bring up for the viewers, and I'm hearing this on TV, is I hear people calling in saying the young people need to do this, the young people in the movement need to do that. You would not believe on how many people are my age, being the middle class, 55-year-olds that are out there every weekend. We don't get to protest every day. I work for a living with a very good job, have a nice house. But there's a group of us in Naperville. We're a small town, a suburb of Chicago. There's about 100 of us now, and it started out with maybe 7 people a month ago. And we protest every weekend. We meet at a certain spot. We protest. We have our GA. We meet during the week. And actually what we're going to start doing now is not only national issues, we're going to start talking about local issues in our community.
Great.
So I just want to let your viewers know, it's not just young, it's all ages. We got retired teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lady that was walking by me last weekend. She was 72 years old. So
yep.
We're all out there trying to push for it.
Good on you. And Bob, thanks for that report, and thanks for the recalibration. It's an important one. Candu in New York City, watching on Manhattan Neighborhood Networks. Hey, what's up?
Oh, man. Oh, so much, man. You know, I've been listening to your show, and one thing that constantly gets at me is I strongly believe that the right wing is basically had people in the Occupy movement. They're infiltrating the Occupy movement, so, you know, they'll start throwing rocks and whatnot. So it'll try and give the movement a black eye.
Yeah.
You know, and I, and another thing, maybe you can answer this question for me. What does, you know, like, we're all Americans. I'm an African American. I have my grievances with the country, but I love this country, wouldn't trade it for the world. But what I don't understand is why is one particular side seem like they're trying to dismantle everything that this country's been built up to become? And what do they stand to gain by doing it?
I think that there is a mentality among people in the 1%. And first of all, let's make it very clear. It's not all of the people in the 1%. In fact, over 60%, 63% or 68% of the people in the 1% in a recent poll, I think it was a Washington Post poll, said, please raise my taxes. So it's actually a minority of the top 1%. But there is this very vocal, very wealthy, you know, the Koch brothers with their billions, you know, 50 billion bucks. I mean, they're worth an enormous amount of money. That basically has this mentality of, well, we'll get behind our gated community and we'll, get a bunch of, we'll hire Blackwater and, we'll have a greenhouse out back and we don't need anybody else. And it's that bizarre me, mine mentality that I think is frankly destroying America. And it came out of Ayn Rand's teachings and her book Atlas Shrugged and all these other things. And can do. Thank you for identifying it. It is a cancer in our society. There's no other way to describe it. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Oh, Zach in Salt Lake City's got something to show you that you're going to love. And we'll be back with The Good, the Bad, the Very, Very Ugly. The good, the bad, and the very, very erythrophobically ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good, Occupy Denver. The mayor of Denver has been demanding that the occupying patriots in that city choose a leader, despite the fact that the 99% movement is, by definition, a leaderless movement. But on Tuesday, the Occupy Denver General Assembly finally complied with the mayor's demand and chose a leader. Shelby, a 3-year-old border collie. All right, seriously. As Occupy Denver's website says, Shelby exhibits heart, warmth, and an appreciation for the group over personal ambition. Shelby is closer to a person than any corporation. She can bleed, she can breed, and she can show emotion. Either Shelby is a person, or corporations aren't people. Occupiers intend to introduce Shelby to the mayor this week, as well as to the governor of Colorado. And this weekend, Shelby will be leading a march against corporate personhood. Looks like the 99% movement has dogs on its side, too. The bad. John McCain, the former Maverick senator turned shill for corporations, is pushing a new bill to let corporations bring back all the money they've stashed away in offshore bank accounts to dodge paying taxes. Instead of being taxed at the corporate rate of 35%, McCain's bill will tax them at a measly 8% rate. He defended the legislation by saying, if you brought back $1.5 trillion to the United States, it's bound to have some positive effect somewhere. I don't see how it would not, even if they buy more yachts and corporate jets and all that. So first McCain screams about the deficit, and then he decides to let corporations off the hook from paying taxes so the millionaire and billionaire CEOs can buy more yachts and corporate jets. I guess John McCain is working hard to be the 1%'s favorite senator. And the very, very ugly Brian Kilmeade. This morning on GOP TV's Fox and Friends, Kilmeade explained what a parent's worst nightmare is. No, it's not hearing that your child is in jail or injured. Instead, it's hearing that your child joined Occupy Wall Street. As Kilmeade said, what is the biggest nightmare for a parent? Waking up in the morning and spotting one of your kids at one of the Occupy movements. Right, because engaging in our democracy and exercising First Amendment rights is downright horrific. Instead, parents want their children to sit quietly in their bedroom playing video games while the country goes down the tubes. Either that or get a gig spewing right-wing talking points on Fox so-called news. Right, Kilmeade? That's very, very ugly. That's, surprisingly ugly, actually. that's remarkable. Jackie in Santa Rosa. Hey, Jackie, what's up?
Hi, Tom. This is Jackie. I was an alternate negotiator for Occupy Santa Rosa.
Mm-hmm.
Tonight at 5 p.m. at Santa Rosa City Hall, it's make or break time for the Occupy people and the people of the government of the city of Santa Rosa. The city of Santa Rosa has led us into negotiations to allow us a permit to keep our tent at City Hall. We have agreed to all their requirements, and now they have done what could be considered a bait and switch. And the question on the agenda, even though we agreed to everything, is now whether they are authorized to give us a permit at all.
Right.
We need the 4,000 people who showed up on October 15th to show up tonight to say, let the tent stay.
Okay.
If the city says no, we need thousands to show up on Saturday morning to say, let us stay.
Okay, Jackie.
But if the city of Santa Rosa says yes, then we need to say thank you. Thank you so much for letting us express our free speech peacefully.
Okay, great.
Jackie, thank you.
Generally, we ask people not to read things on the air, but this is an important one. Very quickly, 5 o'clock tonight, City Hall, Santa Rosa. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Great.
Please support us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Felix in Portland. Hey, Felix, what's up?
Hey, I've been active online with the Occupy Portland movement, and I've been down there a number of times, and just kind of wanted to give you some information on what's been going on.
Great. And how are people handling in Portland Sam Adams' decree statement, whatever, that Saturday midnight, that's it?
Well, he had made an earlier decree saying that such a thing was impending about 2 days ago, and there was a lot of constructive discussion about what type of things needed to be done to clean up the area. To set the stage a little for people who aren't familiar with Portland, Lonsdale and Chapman Park, two side-by-side parks, which are the site of the occupation, represent about a half square mile of space,
right,
completely packed with occupiers.
Right.
Michael Moore was down a week ago Monday and said it was the largest he had seen yet.
Mm-hmm.
So under the weight of all of those people, unfortunately, there are a lot of sanitary problems. And then there is, because it's such a large movement, that was working rather effectively with city government. You're absolutely right in characterizing Sam Adams as somebody who's not the conservative boogeyman that people might fear, like out of Oakland.
Well, even in Oakland, actually, there's a progressive mayor there who has apologized repeatedly, but
right, and she was unfortunately out of town when the first raid went down, and
yeah,
there's some question about whether other people within the city did that.
Right, but I mean, there are some cities where you actually have Republican mayors who are vilifying the Occupy movements.
Right.
That's not the case in Oakland or in Portland. Yeah.
Right. We've been fortunate in Portland to have a city government that's been willing to work with us.
Right.
There's also been an element within the movement who's impatient, we'll say. They want to see more action. They want to see bigger action, and they want to see it now.
Yeah.
And so you may have heard about the expansion occupations into Jameson Park in the Pearl District.
Yep.
Or the federal Terry Shrunk Plaza, which is side by side with Lonsdale and Chapman, neither of which were General Assembly approved.
Hmm.
So the General Assembly is having some difficulty with these impatient folks stepping up and taking actions, and then also obstructing other desires and things that need to get fixed. Like the kitchen was almost taken over in a hostile takeover by people who thought that the experience of people who knew how to run a kitchen and were trying to make it stay within fire code was too oppressive. And so now they're in there cooking vegan meals on bloody cutting boards and flipping food with their hands. And so it all of this has kind of totaled up to make the really dedicated, really, with it people shy away and back away. And there's less and less of an influence of the people who know it, who have a good head about them.
Right.
And even those who have experience with these type of protests and know how to do this type of thing effectively. It may not be too late with the 3-day notice to inject those people back into it and save
right.
it. And there's been a lot of discussion on the forums to try and muster that kind of a thing, but unfortunately, it just doesn't seem like it's coming together fast enough.
Yeah. Well, and there is a very
firebombing yesterday. So,
I beg your pardon.
There was a firebombing. Not yesterday. This was on Monday, which seemed like somebody went out and made their own Molotov cocktail and threw it at the World Trade Center down there off of NATO.
Oh, jeez.
And there was an earlier report that Molotov cocktails were being constructed and stored inside the occupation. Whether that report is valid or not, and whether the firebombing was an agitation or not, we don't know, but that's kind of like the exclamation point on the whole something needs
yeah,
to be done.
And the heroin overdose yesterday.
Yeah, heroin overdose, unfortunately. I haven't heard too much about that, so I can't speak to that. But
yeah. So, this is like the growing pains of the movement, and
exactly.
We'll get through this, and the movement will guaranteed. And I've been saying this from
sure.
day one, it's going to end up fracturing, and there are going to be people, there are going to be crazies who are going to go off. I was in SDS. I had, one of my friends ended up spending a lot of years in prison, because she went off into the weather underground.
Exactly. Yeah, and the site has a very active online site. They've got the forum going. There was what was considered a split when a group called themselves Real Occupy Portland, and when it established a bank account and tried to establish a corporation. It seems that wasn't a total split, and that there may be some ability for people really concerned with Occupy Portland to cling on to that structure, even
right.
if the physical occupation is removed,
yeah,
in order to continue to get the message out there.
Right, so, and you're going to get people, and you're going to get people who are trying to say this is a movement of the Democratic Party, or this is a movement of the Communist Party, or this is the movement of the anarchists, or this is the movement of only right. us, and you know, not them,
well,
and the old timers, not the versus the new timers. It's all going to happen. It's all good stuff. Frankly, because
right.
what it means is
divorcing anarchists from the movement, which a lot of people have said we should try to do because a lot of people feel anarchy doesn't represent nonviolence. However, the General Assembly structure is one the anarchists adopt as something that they developed and have been using far longer than anybody else. So
right.
finding a way to bring those together is a serious challenge. But
yeah.
it's a challenge that, you know, if we one person said on the forum yesterday, if we can't fix this, we can't change the world. So this
well,
is what we kind of have to do.
I would respectfully disagree. I would say just whether you fix it or not, the process of working on it, the process of discussing it, the process, you know, the process itself is changing the world. The,
right.
You know, keep in
and
mind.
That's what my feelings about the movement have been, is that even if the movements don't result in tangible policy changes, the process of going through this is teaching us how to get to that point where we can affect those changes.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think process is, I'm totally with you on that. That's exactly the message. That,
yeah. And,
that
and be careful, you know, assuming that the ends and means are clearly definable and even necessarily associatable. You know, when Elizabeth Cady Stanton
sure.
and Susan B. Anthony were sitting together in 1874, as I recall, or 1884, and planning Susan Anthony's going down to vote in that November, as I recall, maybe it was 1880, whatever the year was, where she got arrested. You know, they didn't believe that in their lifetime they would see women have the right to vote, and they didn't. You know, they died before that happened, and to the best of my knowledge. But that doesn't mean that it didn't, that there wasn't a line between the two. It's like, you know, you stay true to your principles and stay true to the work. And the world will change. It absolutely will. And nonviolence has to be at the core of it. Thank you, Felix.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Oh, and I promise you, Zach from Salt Lake City, we will be back with him and more right after this. 45 minutes past.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, the ashes of the game. Democracy is coming to the USA.
And you can see it all over America. Get out there and occupy something. Zach in Salt Lake City. Hey, Zach, what's up?
Just want to say thanks for having me on, Tom. Appreciate it.
Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I called to just kind of, you know, I think everyone really realizes this, that Rick Perry's a buffoon. That's pretty obvious.
One with a poor memory at that.
What's that?
One with a poor memory.
Oh, I mean, this man's running for president of the United States, and he I mean, this is, what, the 10th time he's blubber-footed his words
yeah.
on live TV?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a GOP, part of the GOP or the Democratic Party, but it just seems to me that if a political party is really putting forward someone of this caliber, then it's a testament to most of the rest of the people in that party. I mean,
yeah,
it's
a
it's
sad
really
commentary,
sad.
Actually. It really is. And you wanted to mention something about the Occupy movement message and money. Do I have that right?
Well, I just wanted to say that, well, the Occupy movement, there seems to be a whole lot of anti-capitalism folk down there, and not all of them are anti-capitalist.
Mm.
But I just want to point out that there's been a distinction between crony capitalism and capitalism, and I think that's the wrong distinction. I think what should really be said is that, well, we have, you know, people who have capitalist ideas but are really, in the government, pseudo-fascists.
Yeah.
They take large amounts of money from corporations to fulfill their political ends and get elected. I mean, even though it's under the guise a lot of the time that these departments and these corporations and these subsidized industries are going to help our country, they don't.
Yeah.
They end up costing us more money. They end up giving us, or they end up giving us
less value for, yeah, I got it. And then they take the jobs overseas. You're absolutely right. Zach, thank you very much for the call. And now John McCain wants to say, hey, and you can bring your money back at only 8%. because maybe they'll buy some corporate jets. No, he's serious, and yachts. He seriously said that. Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom. What we have going on with this infiltration of police and this revelation coming out from this one patrolman is that, first of all, we're making an impact. We got to have the military on our side, and we have to have the police force on our side. Right now, civilian authorities are controlling our military, and they're making huge impact or influence upon the police.
Right.
So what we've got to do is get the governors, we have to get the state representatives on our side because our strength is in unity. We got to get a leader, as President Clinton said. We have to establish a leader for not only this movement, but also this revolution that's not a violent one, but is a revolution of the mind.
Yeah. What typically happens, Michael, when you look at movements like this, and we've seen it with civil rights, we've seen it with suffrage, we've seen it with the anti-war movement, is that the movement grows organically. It reaches a certain point. People with leadership skills or good speaking skills end up kind of bubbling to the surface and become the de facto spokesperson through a fairly organic process. And my sense of it is that the Occupy movement is in the very early stages of that. But your points are very, very well taken and well made. Thank you very much for calling and sharing them with us. Sean in Battleground, Washington. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Tom, out of all the excellent guests that you have on your show, my favorite is economist Richard Wolff from the University of Massachusetts.
Yeah, he's brilliant.
Author of When Capitalism Hits the Fan, and
yep.
Also did a lecture by the same name.
Yep.
But Tom, one of the most important points he makes in the lecture is that re-regulation is not the answer. If we leave the power in the hands of the capitalists, they have every incentive and every means with which to undo all of that regulation. So,
or they design the regulations in ways that establish monopolies for themselves.
Right. And as much as I love Democratic Socialists of America and, you know, all of the reform movements out there, I think we have to look at the fact that in the 1930s, it was the hardcore Communist Party USA which pushed the political agenda to the left. Not reformers, not people who wanted to do incremental change. It was the hardcore revolutionary left that created that change. Wouldn't you agree?
I do agree, actually. And the problem is that they had no idea how that was going to play out in the Soviet Union or in Cambodia or in Vietnam or in China, for that matter, with Mao Zedong.
When Marx was writing the Manifesto in Capital, he believed that communism would evolve out of an advanced industrial society. He didn't think communism would come forth in feudal societies. And when everyone says, oh, well, Marxism didn't work, they're totally ignoring the fact that Marx never said that communism would emerge out of a feudal society. It's supposed to come out of an advanced capitalist society. So,
I think that you could argue that Russia certainly was that at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution, couldn't you?
No, it was a monarchy. It was the Tsar. It was feudal society.
It was. They were also post-industrial revolution. I mean, they were making things. Russia was a substantial. I mean, I don't think that any system has played out well or perfectly. And I mean, these are conversations I remember my father and grandfather having, because my grandfather was a socialist in the old, you know, back when the socialists were, you know, supportive of the Soviet Union in the 30s.
Sure, of course.
And my father was a Republican back when the Republicans were Dwight Eisenhower, you know, were the Peace Party. I think that a lot of people got caught by surprise.
Tom, is it just a coincidence that it's been 20 years?
Well, let me just finish this thought. I think a lot of people got caught by surprise by the horrors of communism as it played out in some of these large countries. As similarly, a lot of people are being caught by surprise now by the horrors of laissez-faire capitalism as it's being played out in the United States and across the developed world. And this is the crisis that Europe is in right now, and this is the crisis that the United States is in right now, is a crisis caused by unregulated capitalism. And so, anyhow, we'll have to continue the conversation another time. We're out of time. But coming up tomorrow, of course, Senator Bernie Sanders will be with us, Brunch with Bernie. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate. Tag, you're it. Get out there and occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman.
For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.